Yeah. Okay. You're listening to
Stack Exchange Podcast number 22.
Maybe another 4 years. With special guest Paul Begar, and we're still waiting on Jeff, but he's on vacation, so we may not actually get him. But Paul and I will start anyway with the Stack Exchange Podcast. So our guest is Paul Begar. Paul, you were a speaker. I guess that's pretty much the first I ever heard of you, although I'm sure you were famous before then. You were a speaker.
At DevDays in London.
And before that, you were just born. Like, you had just been born.
Basically, nothing had happened before then. You elevated me to
world fame.
There we go.
On the stage in front of 900 people, Stack Overflow Dev Days London 2009, where you spoke about scripting languages, and you were the hit of the show, I believe, except for John Skeet, because he had, like, I don't know, sock puppets or something. He had
but you can't beat John Skeet.
Yeah. I mean, if you had brought a sock that you had drawn a puppy face onto,
it wouldn't have worked. It only worked because it was Skeet.
I don't know. I'm pretty sure it was. And he talked about time zones or something, and you talked about
that stuff's really interesting. I'm serious, like, all that localization, you know, shit that just doesn't work, that's fascinating
To somebody. I saw him tweeting about trying to get Muslim dates to work correctly.
Oh no.
Which is impossible because the month only changes over when somebody sees the new moon and then reports it to a tribunal, which judges that he's to be trusted, and then the month flips over, and so if it's a cloudy day in Saudi Arabia or something, then the month just flips over the next day.
And I didn't know they had cloudy days in Saudi Arabia.
Well, they're very rare, but they have happened, so that makes it extremely hard to do correctly. And I think they have I think in Egypt they have some kind of system, like a computerized algorithmical system that they use. But the fact that John Skeet is still working on this makes me feel like he really must love this subject.
Either that, 2 years or later.
Google is very, very, very cruel. We'll get him on the podcast anyway. You talked about scripting languages then,
scripting
and you still
languages, yeah.
like you still love scripting languages. What is your least favorite programming language of all time?
Oh God! Well, obviously PHP is everyone's least favorite scripting language. We don't want to go down a hatred of scripting language vein. But I wrote a compiler and a static analyzer and a code generator for PHP, and the sort of things that a normal programmer experiences and dislikes get all multiplied together when you have to write a static analyzer for it.
Yeah. Well, static analyzers are always something that is left as an afterthought, especially in dynamic languages.
Oh, God, yeah. It's terribly difficult to do static analysis, which is of dynamic scripting languages, which was the entire point of the talk.
So let me try to define static analysis. It's basically looking at a program that is not running, looking at the source code of a program.
Yeah.
Algorithmically, like you run a program that takes as an input another program.
Yeah.
And then you make decisions about whether that program will work or not, or how to make it faster, or...
Yeah, yeah. How to make it faster, whether there's security implications, whether you just made a stupid mistake, like not initializing a variable, all that kind of thing.
And this is the point where everybody who has a undergraduate degree in computer science says, well, of course, that's impossible due to the halting problem.
I love that halting problem argument. I've solved that at least twice.
You heard it here today. Paul Begar has solved the halting problem.
So every time someone comes in and goes, oh my God, that's the halting problem, and completely ignoring all the constraints that you've already set up for why it isn't the halting problem.
Yeah. Yeah. And so basically the halting problem says that it doesn't say that you can't determine things about programs. It just says there exist programs that you cannot determine whether or not they will halt. It doesn't say that all programs you cannot determine whether or not they will halt. And it doesn't say that any programs cannot halt with the
No, but there is a more interesting equivalent to the halting problem, which I think is called Rice's theorem or something like that. And it's also called the full employment for compiler writers theorem. which is that anything that you want to analyze, or anything that's interesting, can't be rigorously analyzed, or something like that.
Anything interesting can't be. No usefulness can come out of PhDs in computer science.
Exactly.
Well, that's a law more about analysis.
There's some truth to that.
Yeah, yeah. But you sometimes you can. I've seen. You know what?
Oh, yeah.
There's a project. I wish I remembered the name of this out of Microsoft that does actually static analysis of code to determine if it has run conditions or race conditions or basically threading bugs.
Is this Thomas Ball's research?
I don't remember, but what I do remember is that, you know, it would make little trees and it would say, you know, these are all the possibilities that this happens before that, that that happens before this. And I think it would try them all by basically running the threads and then holding certain threads, certain amounts of time to try to create, you know, situations, threading bugs, essentially.
Right, race conditions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Somebody in the chat room says it analyzes drivers, so that makes sense because drivers are the source of all woes at Microsoft. Essentially, 99% of all Windows crashes and blue screens of all time have been caused by ATI, the company that makes the graphics card, who writes the drivers for their own cards.
The interesting sort of solution to that stuff is that people have been, you know, people have been applying static analysis, people have been applying dynamic analysis, and there's not that many people who have been doing a sort of a hybrid of the two, and I guess it's a bit much to say it's the solution, but I think it would be very interesting if we saw a lot more of that sort of vein of like combining the two to see, you know, things that aren't supposed to happen at static or, you know, statically happen, you know, in the real world.
Right. So wait, so static analysis, so how do we get into this rat hole? Oh, we said PHP sucks because it's impossible to analyze statically.
No, PHP sucks for many, many other reasons. And it is actually impossible to analyze statically, but that didn't stop me getting a PhD on that topic.
The one thing I remember about PHP is it didn't have a really rigorous concept of what a reference was or what the syntax of that should be. It sounded like it was something that was sort of half-baked. And I noticed that a lot of PHP was inspired by VBScript. And VBScript got into yes, actually, I think it was inspired originally by VB. It was an attempt to make something. I don't remember where I heard that, but, you know, people in the chat room, correct me if it's not VBScript. But there was sort of a demand for a VBScript-like syntax, and VBScript had this very, very weird problem that it had evolved from Visual Basic in a strange way. So Visual Basic was completely statically typed. You knew the type of everything at compile time. And because you knew the type of everything at compile time, you were able in Visual Basic to create default properties, which was a very, very, very bad idea. So if you call an object and you try to read from an object and you leave out the property, so you say like text box and you neglect to say text box dot value, you just say text box, then it would choose the property that was tagged as being default and it would let you read or write that property.
Oh, that's an awful idea.
Right. And so now the problem is what happens if you assign to text box? Does that replace the variable text box with a new thing? Or does that set the default property? And the answer was that you had to use the set keyword if you wanted to change the variable.
There's kind of a generic problem here that you see in scripting languages that people are talking about implicit type conversions and non-implicit. It's like Python really, really does not like its implicit things to happen. And so it says, you know, it will not convert integers to strings for you. And PHP says, you know, you gotta make it easier for the programmer, you know, screw what types are. And actually, the PHP guys, you know, the guys who actually developed the PHP language have said that they feel that programmers should not have to know what types their variables are.
Yeah, well, but I don't even know if that makes sense for a programmer not to know. Now, we had this, the other thing that happened in Visual Basic is that we had this golden rule that you have to be able to say X equals A1, where A1 is an Excel cell. And that means that whatever the hell X is, which you haven't defined up until now, you should be able to take the value out of a cell and then put that in a variable. And a cell could hold a number or a string or a date or a date was a number formatted funny, but it could hold a number, a string, an error value. What else can you put in a cell? I think there were 7 types of things you could put in cells in Excel. A piece of an array, not a whole array, mind you, but only a piece. So there were different types of things that could be in cells, and you wanted to be able to assign these to variables and have it kind of work without having to create a switch statement around the type of the cell where it's like, if cell contains number, then do this, and if cell contains string, do that. And that was sort of the requirement, and so they created this new type called variant in Visual Basic for that purpose that was a type that could hold anything. It was a tagged union, essentially.
Right.
Meaning a variant. It's strongly typed, but it's a structure that contains two things: some bytes and another sentinel that tells you how to interpret those bytes. So that was what Visual Basic did, and the VBScript guy said, "Let's just make everything a variant because this is scripting."
Mm-hmm.
And things got really kind of spooky because I believe in VBScript, the problem, to give you an example, was that if you had the syntax A left banana, 10 right banana, that could mean approximately 10 different things.
Right.
And you
so
only
it sounds knew, like you're not a fan of this dynamic typing sort of thing.
Well, it got really sticky. So A left banana, 10 right banana could be. Just in this case, it got really sticky, and it got sticky
because
that could either mean if A was an object, then that meant call the default property. Call the default property. Hope that it returns a function. If it does, call it with the argument 10. But if the default property is an array, then get the 10th element of it. If there is no default property, if A is an array, then get the 10th element of it. Or if A is either a function pointer or just the name of a function.
You still have this sort of problem in like Python and that kind of thing where everything is polymorphic. So
sure.
Array accesses are polymorphic and you don't know whether...
You can't know until runtime what you're doing.
Exactly. You can't know at runtime what you're doing. And you certainly can't know statically in your editor when you're reading someone else's code what's going
to
happen. Exactly.
You can try to reason about it, but you don't necessarily have, especially depending on how far away the variable was declared. And
yeah, exactly.
So
that's kind of what static analysis is, really. You know, find where this thing can be defined.
Yeah, what are all the places where this might have been set to a different... And it's extremely rare for programmers to actually put different types on the same
variable. That's
right,
yeah. It's very, very rare. So I did a little bit of research on that, and I forget the exact numbers, but it's like 80% of variables in PHP have exactly one type, and then the remaining
80%.
Because of implicit conversions, there's a lot of variables that can be null or a particular type.
Okay.
So the remaining, you know, up to like 95% are one type or null.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly.
Fair enough. And then some of them are just assigns because they come in from the query string and they either become a number or a string or a null kind of at runtime based on
like back in the old days when they used to the global, what are they called, magic variables or something like that automatically took their results from the query string and got, you know, you could overwrite your own variables with things from the query string.
Yeah.
Magic. That was like security bug heaven.
Register globals.
That was it.
Thank God for the chat room, see? There's also bees in the chat room, so stay away from the chat room.
I mean, what chat is complete without bees?
Yeah. I'm sorry. I'm just laughing at the bees. Marco, stop it. Somebody ban Marco from the chat room. It has nothing to do with bees. But what I think what happened with PHP, we're going to finally finish this thought, and then we'll move on to the next thing.
Good idea.
Think what happened with PHP is that a lot of languages are designed by, if it's not a syntax error, if it is a syntax error, it's available to become a feature. So essentially, you get an idea for a language feature. You get some great idea saying, let's do, we need...
Namespaces.
Yeah. What do we need?
Namespaces. That was the most recent fuck-up in
exactly.
the PHP world.
You need namespaces. So you find something that until now is a syntax error, and you make and you use that for your feature.
Yep.
And sometimes you find something that actually, like there aren't enough syntax errors available. So you find something that's really rare, and when it does happen, you can tell it's happening at runtime. And then you kind of overload that. And I think C++ was full of this stuff. Not runtime, obviously, because it's all compile time.
Yeah.
But it was full of this stuff where it's like, yeah, I know that looks like a syntax error, but you can actually tell because of some deep, dark inner secret that you can discover as to whether the syntax means the old thing or the new thing.
There's a book that's full of that, like the design and implementation of C++. Design and evolution of C++.
Uh-huh.
It's like a book that Straustrup wrote about how C++ evolved. Got that way. And it's really, really interesting. And anyone who likes languages or likes C++ and wonders about how the fuck it got that way, it's an awesome book for that.
So that is actually by Bjarni Straustrup.
It is, yeah.
Who is the creator of C++.
Yeah.
And still the defender of C++. I guess that's probably the point of this book, is to defend.
Well, no,
what
the
everybody
book
else
came out of this this conference called The History of Programming Languages, and he presented in that and then turned it into a book and talked about the history of C++.
Which is interesting, and what I remember Stroustrup's major defense of C++ was that it was more of a toolkit for building your own programming language, mm-hmm. using some subset of C++. Than a programming language itself.
So it still remains that C++ is the only language where you can do a certain class of systems programming.
So, really?
So if you're writing large systems programs like GCC or Firefox or something along those lines,
GCC. I would totally write GCC in Python or Lisp. Lisp? You wouldn't write if you had to write a C or a C++ compiler tomorrow. You wouldn't use Lisp.
I would self-host. You always got to self-host.
That's true. Good point.
Yeah.
So,
you can.
Okay, so that's not what C++ is for. Can't be.
No, I mean, so what C++ has that C doesn't have is that it has compile-time metaprogramming. And C kind of has it with macros, but that's the really most awkward
most
sort
rudimentary.
Of way of doing things.
Yeah. And dangerous.
Yeah, and C++ has templates, which, while not awesome, are much, much better than C macros.
So you could theoretically, if you were extremely disciplined and you only use C++ features with great care, you could actually do that kind of metaprogramming, sort of like Lisp macros in a sense.
I think not nearly as powerful.
Where you're almost creating your own language for things, in a sense. Right, like actually, that's what Calm did, I suppose, where they used the templates.
Probably not that much. I'd say it's just able to really do sort of, you know, look at the types statically at compile time and specialize on that behavior. So it's not remotely as powerful as Lispy things. Although it's all template Turing complete, obviously.
Yeah. Frightening.
Mm-hmm.
Enough rope to hang yourself with, I think, was... So this is our entire hating on PHP. We justified nothing. All we sort of did is we vaguely alluded to the fact that the designers of the language did design by finding missing things in the syntax tree and just cramming things in there.
I think that's vaguely true. One thing that I put into my thesis about why PHP was... talking about PHP was that the community was like this sort of awful, discontent, terrible place to be, and that this is why PHP ended up the way that it is. That it's not to do with like,
what?
You know,
really?
Yeah.
When you say the community, you mean the open source developers working on the language?
Yeah, the people working on the language.
Wow.
No, not the people who use PHP, who I'm sure are perfectly nice.
No, they're perfectly nice, but they were rarely trained in programming. Which doesn't help.
Yeah, very true. That's people who are working on JavaScript these days.
Yeah, this is really interesting. What was wrong with those people?
Just like this is the word that I'm trying to think of, but just like the mailing list was just this community that was vicious and aggressive about absolutely everything. You know, the worst mailing lists that there have ever been, and the way Usenet used to be, and how you have to protect your communities from, you know, poisonous people. So that's the word. Yeah. It is just a poisonous community.
Weird. I wonder if it's a cultural thing having to do with the... I don't want to say anything because I'm Israeli myself. So I won't.
No, I don't think so. I don't think it's anything to do with them.
There's a specifically Israeli cultural value that says call people out, always say the truth, don't worry about being tactful. It's better to be honest. And that's a cultural value that is, you know, that has a word. There's a word for that in Hebrew. I can't even describe it in English. That there's a word that says, just tell me straight, tell me to my face the honest truth. That would be better than you trying to cover it up and varnish it.
And I don't think that's it.
No.
I think it's just that there's no one to kind of put a leash on people who behave badly.
Wow. Okay. Maybe that's hard to do because of the... I wonder if that's hard to do because of the software they used or because of the attitudes of the people towards the software that they used.
Probably a combination of both.
My
theory
is that...
We can
tie this into Stack Exchange because in Stack Exchange we do...
Exactly.
Definitely,
community stuff.
Yeah.
So my theory is that the people who really love language design were never really... the kind of people that PHP needed were never really enthused by PHP, and any of them that were scared off by this poisonous community.
Interesting. So you know, what's really kind of cool is that some of the mo- if you just have to list the most popular languages today, you've got PHP, Perl, JavaScript. No, I don't know. I'm just putting it on my list. JavaScript. Right. Because what I'm doing is I'm listing languages that were designed by people that had no business designing languages. And JavaScript actually, Brendan Eich is now an awesome language designer, but that was his first job, I think, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, so certainly at the time, he wrote in 2 weeks and
yeah, and it was scheme-like. And it was it had a scheme-like syntax.
It is just scheme, isn't it?
Well, it had a scheme-like syntax, and he was told for political reasons to make it look like Java and put in some semicolons and stuff.
Yeah,
and it has a bunch of mistakes in it, like the business about how lines end, and whether or not you need semicolons.
And all of this stuff.
Yeah, it actually has some errors in it that, like, I'm sure he regrets. I mean, he's written about it, all the things that he regrets.
Yeah, exactly.
So why are we stuck using so many languages that were designed by people that had no business designing languages? Like, how did they become? Why did these become the most popular languages?
It's like all software. You end up. You make the first version, and it just so happens that a couple of people's first version gets traction, and it's for nothing to do with the intrinsic quality. Value of the language.
Right.
People who try it out haven't seen the edge cases until they get really deep into it. In the case of JavaScript, it was just like, this is, it was blessed, right?
Mm-hmm.
With the case of PHP, it's just that they made it really easy for people to use PHP, and the quality of the language didn't really matter.
Right. What are some other? There's some other really popular languages that are not very well designed. A lot of macro languages, like in the old days, in my days, like years
shell.
Ago, it was like, oh yeah, shell. But that was designed to be typable.
Yeah, but like anyone trying to write a shell script that goes longer than 300 lines is just a special place in hell for that kind of programming.
Yeah, but you shouldn't go longer than 300 lines because it's not gonna. It takes in the old
Unix.
You start
10 lines.
I know, but that's already 20 minutes
grows,
just for
grows,
the time
it
that it takes to start all the processes that you need to create to run a 10-line shell script.
Have you ever read a configure script?
No.
So these are like 20,000 lines of shell that's automatically generated by a program that's written in like Perl.
Yeah.
And takes into account these libraries that are written in M4, which is the world's worst macro language.
Right. A very simple macro language that was probably written with the original, probably came with the original Unix. If I'm not mistaken,
all very good ideas at the time, and then when they all combine together, so that's the problem with all these languages, that they start nice for simple purposes, and then they outgrow their purpose.
And yet you have these other languages that are designed by the world's greatest experts on designing languages, Haskell, OCaml.
Mm-hmm.
Haskell actually was this committee of computer language geniuses from every university in the world.
Yeah.
And it was performant, and it was both statically typed and dynamically typed, and it had all the latest trendy cool stuff, and it had semicolons or new lines, your choice, and it never became very popular at all.
So if you look at the way Simon Peyton Jones talks about it, he's the head of the committee or something like that, and he says that there's two kinds of languages. There's ones that start safe and you try to get performance out of it, and then there's ones that start that start performance and they try to get safety back.
Mm-hmm.
And that Haskell chose the former of those two.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, it almost stuck itself down as an educational or as an academic language. And it just so happens that it was the one academic language that escaped from academia, not really through anyone trying to do so.
Barely escaped from academia.
We're talking about it on a podcast, right? How many academic languages can we say that about?
Yeah. I only know about it because one of my professors was on the committee.
Right.
To this day. Well, there's F#, right, which is from that same
school. But then that was designed by Microsoft to be like, functional languages for the masses, right?
Yeah.
Got to work with C#, got to work with the Visual Studio stack. And it seems to be roughly OCaml in Visual Studio packaging.
Right. With access to all the nice .NET libraries and stuff like that.
Yeah,
so it's actually
that
kind of useful.
That makes a big deal, doesn't it?
Yeah, that actually makes it so that you could do productive work theoretically. I don't know if anybody does.
I've been writing a bit of closure recently, which is Lisp on the JVM. And
is like a Lisp. Closure is like a Lisp-like syntax, only it generates Java bytecodes.
Yeah, that's right. So it's not just Lisp-like syntax. It is a proper Lisp.
Mm-hmm.
And it's awesome because it's lispy and functional and elegant the vast majority of the time. And if you really, really need it, it's very, very simple to just call some Java stuff.
Right. Okay, I want to go. The chat room says, "What about Dart?"
Google Dart. So, I haven't looked at the language too closely, although the commenters on Hacker News seem to hate it. but they hate everything, right?
Yeah. No. Yeah. No.
Pretty much.
Oh, come on.
Name something they don't rail against.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's
Bitcoin.
A function of commenting
they
that
like
they
Bitcoin.
Hate. Them. Not the commenters. It's this function of commenting, right? That people only comment on the things that they hate.
That they disagree with, right? They only bring
up. Yeah, so like when you write a blog post or whatever and people on Hacker News, you know, discuss it, 90% of people are like, oh, that was really interesting, and they don't say anything. And then 10% like hate it with like a vitriol.
Do we know anything about Dart? No, let's...
So they released a spec or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, it's fully... They have a full implementation that's ready to go in Chrome or something like that. But they kind of... They didn't do themselves any favors with the way that they did it. Mm-hmm. So instead of, you know, doing it at least roughly out in the open and they did it the Google way, not roughly the Mozilla way.
Right. Which is really strange. When I saw it, it just had all the markings of like an internal Google research project, like something that would come out of Microsoft Research, and that was then and it's cool when something comes out of Microsoft Research, but if then the press reports on it as if Microsoft has announced the new Windows programming language will be Omega Sharp.
But isn't that what Google has done? They've said, you know, this is going to be the future language of the web, and everyone else has gone, oh, we kind of like JavaScript.
Yeah. I don't know if we like JavaScript. We like CoffeeScript.
CoffeeScript is lovely, isn't it?
That's what all the cool kids are using. I was just talking.
Yeah, no, it just takes away all the unpleasantness of JavaScript and makes it pretty.
It just occurred to me. I may be crazy here, but it seems like what all the cool kids are using is so new that there isn't even an O'Reilly book yet, right? Like everybody's using CoffeeScript, Socket.io, Backbone, Node. Not even Node.js anymore.
Are you talking about the cool kids or the people who made Trello in your office?
The people that made Trello in my office are very, very cool.
Right.
One of them even has the tortoise shell glasses and everything. What else are the cool kids using?
MongoDB.
MongoDB, yeah.
Oh, there's
probably
we go.
A Mongo
there we go.
Book. But it's amazing that the sort of the out there technology is like still kind of broken in 0.1.
Yeah, it's amazing how many people are building like businesses around technology that isn't quite, you know, where they're still fixing bugs as they go.
Yeah, well, you kind of can.
Maybe there's a correlation there.
There, you know, I wrote an article a long time ago on this blog I used to have, and the article is entitled "Up the Tata Without a Tutu," and it talks about not using risky technologies. Like, don't take risks with your technologies because you're already taking enough risks. Like, if you have a business, you're taking a huge business risk. There's all kinds of other risks you can take.
But then you alienate some cool kids.
Yeah, but that's okay. Screw them. However, so we built our first product in VB. That was from an era when you couldn't necessarily fix the bug. If you were using the latest Microsoft technology and they had some horrible bug in there, you were screwed because you didn't have the source to it. So you couldn't just fix the source. And if you were using, and not only that, but your app, you were shipping it and you were putting it on disks and you were mailing it to people once a year. And so that thing that you mail to people had to be pretty darn good and pretty robust when it got out in the field.
Right. There's no sort of continuous integration deployment of your language runtimes.
Yeah. So basically
and
nowadays...
It's kind of a Microsoft stack problem as well, right?
A little bit. Yeah, they're still doing that where if the stack is never updated, you don't have access to the source code necessarily on the thing that's broken. Although Microsoft, basically, I think what I wrote then, and it's still kind of true, is that Microsoft ships very robust stuff. So there's very little chance you'll build something on .NET and it won't work because of a .NET bug. That's just you don't hear a lot of that those kind of stories. So the fact that they don't give you the source code is not the end of the world because they actually give you working code. So you basically have a choice. You can take broken code with source or working code without.
Well, I think that's a bit of a false dichotomy.
No, it's not a true dichotomy. It's like you have to do one or the other. You either have to be able to fix the source
or it has to work.
Those are my two options. I got you.
It
would be ideal to have the source and have it actually work. That would be Emacs. But these crazy new languages like CoffeeScript and stuff like that, you just throw it out there, and if it doesn't quite work, then you know you either hammer it into working condition, you get a fix, and you roll it out.
And with CoffeeScript, you tend to find that something's not working. You haven't indented it quite right, which is the worst kind of problem to have.
It's like the make files, right? Oh, it's a I put four spaces in there, and it's supposed to be a tab.
At least that will error.
Okay, enough about programming languages. Tell us what you did after then. You started a YC startup.
Me and MPG, best buds. Myself and a friend started this journalism startup that was a terrible idea for people who weren't interested in journalism. But right. We didn't start it as that. We started as I was very interested in commenting and the community building and kind of making how all these newspapers had terrible sort of communities around them, and you could fix that with a combination of better technology and better community policing. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, newspapers didn't have any money, so we kind of pivoted into be the future of journalism, which is the worst idea in the world and something you want to stay the hell away from.
Okay, future of journalism. I'll make a note of that.
Yeah.
Future of journalism business.
If your business involves journalism, avoid.
I think people have been saying that about education too.
Lately. Yeah, very much so.
Another business that seems like a big business, but is actually utterly impoverished.
Yeah.
So what was NewsTilt? It was going to be a journalism thing, and it was the worst idea ever. Why was it so bad? What were all the... You actually wrote a very good blog post about that, which people will read in the show notes.
Oh, cool. Yeah, that was 8,000 words about why why I should never have been doing it in the first place. But like, there was a lot of reasons that it kind of failed. Most of them were sort of, we could have overcome in some way, or we could have changed what we were doing in a certain way. But me and my co-founder actually were kind of having issues which stopped that from working all that well.
So the heart of it was mommy and daddy weren't speaking.
Very much so. And the rest of things could, there was tons and tons of other problems, but you can't really solve those problems when mommy and daddy aren't speaking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you were, but were you like living together? I mean, was this, were you in different cities?
So initially we were living together. We moved to Mountain View to do Y Combinator, and right. Then did that for 3 months. And in the middle of that, we had our major pivot to start working on the future of journalism. And then we moved out of America, moved out of Silicon Valley. I went back to Dublin. He went back to Cambridge. Ah. There's a problem as well, right? We moved out of Silicon Valley.
I personally could not care less about it. I do not give two hoots about Silicon Valley, but you were in different cities.
I don't know. Like I used to feel that, you can do startups anywhere, but actually from having been in Silicon Valley, and I know that you're a big fan of New York and that kind of thing, but being in Silicon Valley makes a big difference for young startups.
Sometimes positive, sometimes negative.
Well,
we can talk about that for a while. Let's talk about that.
All right.
Forget New York. New York is a red herring, because New York does have a lot of the same infrastructure as Silicon Valley. It does less of it, definitely. Okay. But it has that infrastructure. It's not like you can't meet VCs or go to, coffee shops and over here and bump into people.
Well, okay, so Ireland doesn't have this sort of thing. It has the occasional VC.
Right.
It has the occasional startup. But any of those startups that really want to succeed, you got to get the hell out of there, and it's unfortunate, but you have to move to Northern California.
It doesn't have the infrastructure of like angels and advisors, like the YC / angel world. Yeah,
and it doesn't have serendipity. That's what you get from Silicon Valley.
This is the trouble. This serendipity is just bumping into people and then doing the same startup they just did.
No, it's bumping into people, and they know the guy who knows the guy who you really need to talk to right now.
Okay.
So there's the amount of times that, I needed something, and then I was talking to someone at a party, and he knew a guy, and that guy didn't actually help, but he knew the guy, and so on. It solves so many problems.
Hmm. Okay. It's probably, it's hard to tell. I think for every time there's a Silicon Valley company that I feel like they're like deep in crazy Silicon Valley groupthink.
There's no shortage to that.
They all sort of believe the same thing at exactly the same time.
And there's all sort of fanboys.
There's right ways to do it and wrong ways to do it, though. If you're taking advantage of the serendipity that Paul was talking about, where it's like, oh, this guy is able to help me, that's the proper way to do, like, the being embedded in the middle of Silicon Valley. Yeah. The problem is that too many people are doing, like, the, oh, my God, I'm going to do, you know, what I call, like, Foursquare for squirrels.
Foursquare for squirrels.
So it's just, like, the millionth iteration on this successful company. And so now the worst possible combination is, yeah, when you're sitting in the middle of nowhere, like, in the middle of Ireland without any support, and you're trying to do Foursquare for squirrels. It's another thing if you're sitting in the middle of Ireland, though, and, like, trying to build a real business that's, you know, based on a need that you've seen from your life there.
Right, right.
You actually might be able to pull it off. But there is the advantage to being able to be at a party and be like, yeah, you know, I need, like, I was trying to talk to this company to do a partnership deal or something, or, you know, get exposure to, like, an API of theirs that's private. The guy's like, oh, yeah, my friend's the VP of engineering there. Let me connect you.
So you meet people faster. And stuff. I do actually feel like I'm not a good example at all because, for one, I know more people in Silicon Valley
and
than I know
famous.
In New York.
You can email anyone and you're Joel Spolsky.
Yeah, all right, forget it. So I don't count.
Yeah.
But the truth is, every once in a while you see a company like 37 Signals that does pretty well going against the grain of Silicon Valley. And if they had just sort of followed everybody else down that path, they would have been, you know, yet another company, but they actually managed to sort of zig where people were zagging.
Yeah,
I guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's also the cultural differences. Like, I haven't yet seen, what's kind of weird is that there are still no decent startups out of India, and there will be, and they're going to be interesting because they're going to actually understand an audience and a market that's so radically different than the Northern California market, right? Like, Uber cab would never come out of India, but, you know, maybe
I presume that there are loads of startups there, and they're servicing India's you know, startup needs.
The startups that are in India are generally like, let's do outsourcing for American back office operations payment processing. There are very few that actually have product ideas and go run with them. They exist, but they're pretty rare. But they have this sort of nice ability to actually take the good coders that they have over there, and combine them with, like, actually intuition into a gigantic marketplace that nobody can figure out in Silicon Valley because they're too busy making ways to pay 30% more for a cab ride to the airport. Where was I going with that? Okay, I have a question for you now, honestly. You guys gave up, well, actually, you gave up a little early, but you were in YC before the whole Yuri Milner, here's an extra...
Yeah.
What was it, 150,000?
150,000, yeah.
Yeah. So, okay. What would have happened if you had been in the round, if you had gotten the 150,000?
So, I think what probably have happened is that we would have changed what we were doing completely.
So, you would have taken the money?
Yeah. We would have had the money at that point.
Yeah.
You know, we would have taken it on, like, day one.
Sure. And now you're basically operating with, you raised a total of, let's say, 50,000 or something?
We raised 50 and then YC gave us like 17, so we would have had like just over 200.
Yeah, you would have had enough money to, you might have hired somebody.
We definitely have hired someone. So what might have happened is...
Their job could have been to basically, for you, every time you needed to talk to your co-founder, that person's job would be to convey the messages.
So
tell her there's too much salt in the brisket. Sorry, that's what it was like to go to, you know, I had this friend with... grandparents, and you would go over to their house, and they weren't speaking. They'd been married for 90 years, and they would shout at each other, and they would invite people over to the dinner table just so that they could yell at each other through the guest.
Anyway. So I think what would probably have happened is maybe our first iteration might have succeeded a bit more. We might have been able to hire like sales guys to make that work, or I know it's kind of hard to predict this sort of thing. We might just have done something completely different, or we might have, like, you know, parted ways and one of us would have done something different. Yeah, that sort of thing.
Because I'm sort of playing around with this hypothesis, which may be crazy, but my hypothesis is that startups these days have it too easy. And they don't fail
in my
enough.
Day, we have to raise our own money.
Yeah, well, no, it's true. And that's why you get all these really crappy ideas.
It's not just that. It's that you don't stop with a crappy idea. You keep going.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, definitely. Like, we had a roughly crappy idea.
Yeah.
And if we had that money, we would have kept going. There would have been no two ways about it.
Like, there would have been no reason to solve your problems because you wouldn't have had them.
Well, you would have had to solve them eventually. You know, like,
but much
it's
later,
not like
yeah.
we could have hired five guys because we would have run out of money in like 4 months or something.
Yeah, fair enough. I see. The trouble is that these days it's not just the Yuri Milner money. It's that it's very hard to go to demo coming out of Techstars and Y Combinator and not raise $1 million.
Right.
It's like you actually have to be.
Instantly raise money coming out of Y Combinator, like shut your company down right now, yeah. Because that just means you have an awful idea.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know how much, what percentage of Y Combinator companies raise money?
Oh, it's like 95% or yeah. Something. I saw some stats about it.
Well, cause,
like, well, people
with,
raise
with
significant
the demo
money.
Days, you literally have investors standing outside the exit to YC waving checks at them. Like there
they
of,
do like on my demo day they had to come by and like shoo off the investors who weren't invited but who came anyway.
Yeah. And yeah. The worst part is like look, you know, well Ron Conway's a bad example because he gives 150 to everyone. But the sophisticated angels, yeah, they're not going to invest in these crappy companies. But there's for every like good sophisticated angel like that, there's five unsophisticated angels who are like, oh, well, they went through Y Combinator, so they must be a good company, so I'll give them $50,000.
Right.
So, but then, and that's not a bad sort of acid test. Like, if you don't have the ability to tell whether something is good or not, take someone else's opinion first.
No, if you don't have the opinion to tell or not, you shouldn't be investing in something like
I mean, tell that to all the VCs in the entire world.
Well, no, but yeah, put your money in a mutual fund. You should not be doing seed stage startup investing right. If you do not have the judgment ability to judge startups.
So,
well,
no,
I think it's
but
more
they do that anyway. It is very complicated. But what I do see happening quite a lot, though, is that the people raise the easy $750,000 from a team of 10 angels that weren't paying attention and don't care and expect to lose all their money. And then, the angels lose all their money. But this poor startup goes on for 2 years when it probably should have stopped, and they don't make like, you know, kind of crucial decisions because they feel like they have a bunch of buffer.
So I think that you're kind of predicating a lot of this on the idea that there's, you know, startups that are coming out that have stupid ideas that nobody wants and that kind of thing. And, you know, no one is saying they don't exist. They definitely exist. But I think that the model that those investors are using is that there are companies out there that you should just give them money to because they're going to be fucking awesome. And
the cost of that is that you have to give money to all companies.
Yeah. And there's a couple, there's a bit of collateral damage and who cares if those guys take our money and spend 5 years doing nothing with it.
Yeah. So it's basically it's a combination of, what's it called in investing where you have a diversity of things that you've invested in and hopefully one of them will come out well.
The reason that it came about is that people aren't looking for like a 5x return or a 10x return. They're looking for a 1000x return. And whether or not they make money for their, you know, for the investors to their funds is whether or not they find the next Google or the next Twitter. Right. And so it really doesn't matter throwing 25 grand here and 100 grand there. You know, they're working out of pots of hundreds of millions hoping to find the next big Twitter. Which will
pay for all of them,
everything, you know, to 100 times over.
I still feel like these companies, sometimes what happens is like there's like three co-founders, and only one of them is any good, and if they ran out of money, two of them, the not so good ones, might have gotten a job, like they would.
So with the Y Combinator people that I've met, you know, certainly a few of them get in, but. The amount of talent that you actually see, you know, the stereotype that you described there isn't what I perceived from Y Combinator at all.
They're all really talented, so
I mean,
it's okay.
I meet those guys in the pub in the Valley, and they're like, "Oh my God, I'm making Facebook for dogs," and you know, you roll your eyes and you move on. Yeah. But you know, I don't know if they're the same companies that are being invested a million into.
Maybe not. Maybe okay. Cool. So NewsTilt, you shut down. You did not get along with the co-founder. You were doing the wrong thing. And you didn't care about journalism, as you wrote in your article.
Yeah.
You could not care
less.
And that is a real problem because, as Steve Jobs said, the only thing that keeps you friggin' going is loving what you do.
Yeah, very much so, yeah.
Yeah, which is what we're all about.
I need to work on compiler stuff. That's my calling in life, I think.
Interesting. So what are you doing now?
So actually, for the last few weeks, I've been working with a friend who has a startup that I want to pimp, CircleCI.com, which is a continuous integration startup.
Try it out, folks. CircleCI.com.
Yeah, and that is fantastically interesting in the sense of like what you can do with cool compiler stuff to make people's lives better and more productive.
What is
developers' lives? So
that's
it's you know the when people have continuous integration or like, you know, build system, build to the daily builds or whatever you called it back in the Joel.
The Joel test. A daily build was like, that was like pretty good. Wow, we built once a day. We managed to get the source code stable enough to build once a day. But nowadays.
So these days, everyone wants, you know, every single build must work.
Yeah.
And
you have better version control than you did in those days, right? Because you have distributed version control, so you got lots of versions. So there's always something that can build.
Yeah. So what Circle is doing is they're trying to make this as fast and as awesome as humanly possible. So, you know, as easy to use and just basically do, I guess, what Heroku did for hosting to continuous integration.
Mm-hmm.
And there are tons of fantastic compiler problems for people working there behind the scenes. So there's like, you know, all sorts of dependency analyses and trying to determine, okay, you wrote, you know, your chain set is these five lines of Python. How many tests can we statically determine we actually need to run to be able to tell you that this code is perfect and we can push it to your website?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And if you can do that in 2 minutes instead of an hour and a half, that makes a big difference to developers' lives.
Oh, amazingly, yes. Everything is about getting the short redevelop print loop or whatever you call it, the make a change, test it. Yeah.
So that's something I've been helping out with the last while. That it's pretty interesting. CircleCI.com. I just want to pimp them.
Cool. But that's actually sort of interesting. You could see if you talk to anybody that's developed Android and iPhone, both Android apps and iPhone apps, and you ask them to compare and contrast basically the tool sets and the compilers that are available and stuff like that. What the first thing they always tell you is because there's a native iPhone. Not an emulator, but an actual native iPhone app that you can run on a Mac that is natively running your code. It's so much faster to develop than it is for Android, because on Android, you're constantly having to download it to a device every time you compile.
Yeah. And you've got this weird cross-compilation toolkit.
Yeah, yeah. So basically, this is what the Android developers basically complain about that the iPhone developers don't, is that their whole coding cycle, circle to circle of coding, basically how long it takes me to make a change and then see it realistically is so much slower that it's kind of like going back to punched cards.
You see it as well in the gaming wars between Xbox and PS3. Sony had this horrific development cycle or development tools, and Microsoft spent all its time chipping away at Sony's lead by making their development tools absolutely awesome. It's exactly the same as, like, you know, you're in Visual Studio, you click deploy or something like that, and now it's running on the next box. And Sony has like this, you know, buggy GCC Porsche tool chain thing that, and you have to develop for like 8 cores on this thing, and there's no help at all. And they just like squandered this giant lead they had with the PS2 by, you know, Microsoft's clever.
Not worrying about the developers.
Yeah,
developers, 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 developers.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, you couldn't be more right.
We are almost out of time, and I wanted to talk to you about your the Dev Days, which did not happen. And you were going to give a talk in San Francisco, which would have been about today.
Today or tomorrow.
But just tell the people what it would have been about and where they can find your slides.
So I didn't actually make the slides because I didn't make the talk. But the thing that I was going to talk about is kind of a message that I do want to get out there, which is that working on compilers is really, really easy. And people have this idea that it's like something only wizards can do. But writing some part of a compiler is exactly the same as manipulating a DOM using JavaScript. It's exactly the same concept. You have this tree that represents a language, and you're fiddling with it.
Right.
Somebody
has to show you what a parser and elixir are, and how to make elixir and how to make a parser.
This is what kills compiler development, right? That people start. I'm writing a compiler. Step one, I will write a parser. If you want to work in compilers, never go near parsers.
You should just use
the devil spawn.
You should just use Yak and Bison and whatever.
No, not even that. You know, you use Clang. Use someone's existing parser. You know, if you're writing something for JavaScript, you know, there are JavaScript parsers out there. You know, don't touch a parser.
Start on the AppSec syntax tree, essentially. But that's because you think that's what's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I question how many people are, you know, try to write compilers so that they could learn about parsing.
True, fair enough. Like they're trying to do the interesting stuff. That said, yeah. If you're trying to make up a language,
trying to make a language, yeah.
I feel most of the programmers that I talk to who just cannot even comprehend what a compiler does and are afraid of it. As soon as you break it down to the traditional steps of Lex, parse, syntax, create a syntax tree, you know, walk the syntax tree, and then maybe people optimization at the end, you know, code gen and then optimization. And if you just actually show them those steps, they'll realize that they know how to do every single one of those, and they're not that hard.
I think if instead of focusing on, you know, these are the steps of a compiler, you instead look at, you know, how you know, actual compilers are done these days. So like if you look at a Clang or LLVM or something like that, it's something that has a parser at the front and code generation at the end. And in the middle, there's all these cool optimization steps and things you can experiment on and do cool static analysis with. And that's exactly as simple as manipulating a DOM. You're just taking the language representation, twiddling it a bit, looking at it, and you don't need to learn about people optimizations. You don't need to read the Dragon Book, which also I think is a terrible book.
You can just pick your one stage. All right, we are completely out of time. Paul, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
They can find you. We can find you. Let's see, you're Paul Biggar, B-I-G-G-A-R, on the Twitters.
Yep, and .com.
Yep, and if you Google that, you find all kinds of useful stuff. And CircleCI.com, which the chat room is trying valiantly to bring down right now as they speak.
Oh, excellent.
And
Heroku does for us.
Yeah, it's running on Heroku. So Paul was telling me earlier to the people in the chat room, it has to spin up an instance the minute you go to that URL. So that's why it's a little slow.
Things that need work.
Yep, and for all the other links to all the other stuff that we've mentioned all kinds of useful things. There's a book in there, and there's a great blog you wrote about shutting down NewsTilt. The links will be in the show notes at blog.stackexchange.com. Next week, I wrote this down. Next week we have some kind of game theme, right? Alex, extra credit.
It's the guys from the extra credit.
Do we know names? Anything? You know what extra credit is, right? Everybody knows extra credit. It's video games stuff on the Penny Arcade.
It's James Portnow.
Yeah. Thanks. We'll see y'all next week.
Bye.